Thank you very much. So it's a pleasure for me to be here and to thank the organizers for giving the opportunity to give this talk. So what will I be talking about? Well, I will start with some brief introduction to the notion of compact quantum groups and discrete quantum groups. And then the talk will basically consist of two parts. There will be a discussion of some older work that I did with Roland Vernioux on boundaries of certain discrete quantum groups, and mainly about the applications of these boundaries. Namely, it proves exactness of certain C-star algebras, and it proves a property that Takao-Zawa called solidity of von Neumann algebras. So, meaning that these certain C-star algebras and these certain von Neumann algebras are associated with certain quantum groups, and these boundaries prove their exactness and solidity. And then it's slightly the same theme, but nevertheless quite different. Certain boundaries arise in a probabilistic way, as you know, for groups, namely, for instance, as Poisson boundaries for random walks. And that's another part that I will discuss at the end of the talk. So what is a compact quantum group? Well, let us mainly introduce the definition to fix a notation. We have seen these things sometimes already this week. So for me, a compact quantum group G is a pair that consists of a unital C-star algebra C of G and a co-multiplication delta. And this co-multiplication is, of course, a star homomorphism, and it satisfies co-associativity, and it satisfies this set of density conditions that we have met before. So the notation C of G is not to suggest that there is some hidden space G, because there isn't, but it is to suggest you the basic example where C of G is a commutative C-star algebra, and then exactly you get the compact group, and that's just to give you some intuition of what everything means. Now, why am I interested in these objects today? Well, mainly in order to construct and study certain operator algebras. And where do they come from? Well, the basic theorem is the one that Voronovich proved, namely, if G is such a compact quantum group, this unital C-star algebra has a canonical state called Haar state. It's the unique invariant state, invariant under the co-multiplication, on C of G. And once you have this state, you can build a C-star algebra, a new C-star algebra, and a von Neumann algebra by looking at the GNS representation, and you get the reduced C-star algebra of G, and you get this von Neumann algebra that I will denote L infinity of G. And of course, if G is a compact group, this is of absolutely no interest, but the potential interest comes from the following thing, namely, at least you get something we know very well, namely, if G can be the dual of a discrete group. So in that setup, C red of G is reduced C-star algebra, L infinity of G is nothing else than group von Neumann algebra, and co-multiplication is given in this way. So at least this shows that potentially, if I give you some interesting examples of compact quantum groups, here we get some interesting operator algebras, because we have not to convince you that here you can get interesting C-star and von Neumann algebras. So let me now first discuss a bit introductory material that we will need later on. So the first part is about representation theory. So fix such a C-star algebra, such a compact quantum group G, so it consists of the C-star algebra C of G and a co-multiplication. And what is an n-dimensional representation, unitary representation of this object? Well, it's nothing else than an n times n matrix, Uij, with the Uij belonging to my C-star algebra C of G. And then you see matrix multiplication appear, if you want, in a dual way. This is the relation they should satisfy. And now, basically everything you know from representation theory of compact groups holds true for this setup. So for instance, it's quite obvious if you look at this definition that you can make direct sums. You put just matrices, for you it's like this, in along the diagonal. And it's clear that if I have two n and an n-dimensional unitary representation, it's quite clear what it means to have an intertwiner and what it means to be irreducible, and all these things you can somehow invent when you look at this definition. And in particular, you can invent a notion of tensor product, namely if U is a K times K matrix and V is an N times N matrix, you build an NK times NK matrix in the obvious way, and you immediately see that it still satisfies this. That's the notion of tensor product. Mm. Now, the only slightly delicate thing is to define the contragradient. So if I have such a Uij, it's obvious if I take the star, the adjoint of every Uij, that I still satisfy this formula. But of course, I don't have a unitary matrix, because, well, it's the transpose of the adjoint of the matrix, if you want, and this does not preserve unitarity in the if C of G is not a commutative sister algebra. But the main theorem is that although this is not a unitary matrix, it can be unitarized. So that's what Voronovich proved. You find an invertible scalar matrix F such that this F U bar F inverse is a unitary matrix, and that up to unitary conjugacy is uniquely defined, and that's what we call the contragradient of U. And you should keep this in mind because it will be a very important motivation when we look at examples, and it will appear several times later. And that's also the good point to say one other very general thing, and maybe I make some light to write some. It's the last one. Namely, you also have this universal sister algebra that you can construct, because the span of all these Uij, where U runs through all possible finite dimensional representations, that they form a star algebra. It ends in C of G. And this Cu of G is nothing else than it's an enveloping sister algebra. So this is still very elementary, of course, because you simply, if you look at G, the dual of gamma, of course, all these the irreducible finite dimensional representations are simply one dimensional, are the UGs itself. You see the UG satisfy UG, since UG tensor UG. This span is simply group algebra, and this becomes the universal C star gamma. So this already suggests, of course, by construction you have this homomorphism, reducing homomorphism if you want, from Cu of G to C red of G. And if this happens to be an isomorphism, we call the compact quantum group co-amenable. So it corresponds in this case of G being gamma hat, of course, to gamma being an amenable group. So that's just to fix some notations and ideas. Okay, well, let's look back at this contragradient relation. Well, it's the source to define two classes of universal quantum groups. Because what do we see from this? Well, whenever you have a compact quantum group with an n-dimensional unitary representation, you already have some minimal relations in your sister algebra. And the minimal thing you have is that there must exist an S such that this is unitary, which is not always the case. I mean, there is no reason if I take a unitary matrix in an arbitrary sister algebra that I can find such an S that does this job. So this is the source of two families of universal compact quantum groups that were defined by von Dahlo, Wang, and studied a lot by Theodor Banikow. And I will put them in two columns. They are very much related. So they are all labeled by invertible matrices F. So fix such a matrix and keep it fixed. Yeah. and I will define you two quantum groups. Well, in both cases, the unital C-star algebra C of G is defined as a universal C-star algebra with generators and relations. And in the first, in both cases, we have the relation that says that this n times n matrix should be a unitary matrix that already imposes you some relations on the UIJ. And then in the first family called AOF, orthogonal universal quantum group, you impose that U equals F U bar F inverse. That's a strong way to be unitary again, of course. It's saying that U is equivalent to its contragradient in the quantum group setting. In the more universal, the universal unitary case, you simply impose that F U bar F inverse is again a unitary matrix. This gives you a moment of thought. We'll show you that you have a well-defined universal unital C-star algebra. And, of course, you can put the unique co-multiplication on it. You simply check that this preserves all relations, and you get a nice compact quantum group. Now, the famous example of Voronovich, namely SUQ2, appears exactly in this setting, namely if you take for F a 2x2 matrix, namely this one, then you can check if you write out that mu is unitary and that you have this equality, you find exactly the SUQ2 relations. So for us, if you don't know what SUQ2 is, no point, no problem. It's simply the one you get with this specific matrix. But that's probably not the best way to think of SUQ2. I agree, but anyway. Now you wonder, well, why do you have here this mysterious relation FF bar plus or minus 1? Well, the whole point is that if I write you this relation, you will find that FF bar is a self-intertwiner of U. So U, by construction, is an n-dimensional unitary representation of my compact quantum group G. And if this relation holds, FF bar will be an intertwiner of U with itself. So if already we want this, say, fundamental representation U to be irreducible, we have to impose that FF bar is a scalar. It's then a positive scalar, and you renormalize that it's then a real scalar, I mean, and you renormalize it to be plus or minus 1. So this is simply to have the U that we will call the fundamental representation of this example, to have this U an irreducible representation. And on the other side, you don't have this kind of condition. Now, we will be interested in the representation theory of these compact quantum groups. So by their very definition, they are defined having this U as an n-dimensional unitary representation. So let's now build new representations, simply by tensorizing and decomposing into irreducibles. And that's exactly what Theodor Banika did, but let me make a final remark before showing you that. Namely, apart from this case, AO of a 2x2 matrix, all the quantum groups that you see here are non-coamenable. And why am I saying this? That means that potentially all the reduced C-star algebras and all their von Neumann algebras might be interesting operator algebras, things we don't know yet, because they will be non-injective von Neumann algebras, or they will be non-nuclear C-star algebras. Yeah. Okay. So what is this representation theory? Well, the first case of AOF is the easiest case, and Banika showed, well, that something very well known appears, namely exactly the same fusion rules as for the group SU2. Namely, you can label the irreducible representations of G by half integers, positive half integers, and the decomposition of a tensor product is exactly as it happens in the group SU2. And slightly more is true. Whenever you have a compact quantum group with this kind of fusion rules, it must be one of these AOFs. So it describes exactly the compact quantum groups with the fusion rules of the group SU2. By the way, here is maybe an interesting remark. You then, of course, say, well, what happens for other compact classical groups? And, of course, we still have this Drinfeld-Jimbo deformations, and sometimes we have many, many more deformations with the same fusion rules. But even for the case of SU3, there is by no means a real classification theorem that says you which are all the compact quantum groups with the same fusion rules as SU3 or SUN in general. This is completely open. It's a very hard classification problem. But in SU2, it works perfectly. Now, the thing that we should keep in mind is that the fusion rules are abelian. So it's, of course, obvious because they are the same as the ones of SU2. But why is this slightly amazing? Well, I said that from the moment on where F is at least a 3x3 matrix, we will get some non-injective von Neumann algebras. So this is slightly strange because purely on the level of representation theory, we have a purely abelian situation. So this non-injectiveness and so on will come from a completely different site, if you want. So because you should keep in mind that if G is the dual of a group gamma, then simply the fusion rules are the product in the group. Yeah? So from the discrete group side, this seems to be rather abelian. That's what I wanted to stress. Now for AUF, something very funny happens. Namely, Banika showed that the irreducible representations of G can be labeled by the free monoid onto generators. So of course, say that alpha corresponds to your fundamental representation U that defined the quantum group. And what are now the fusion rules? Well, take two words, so elements in this monoid are of course simply words in alpha and beta. I take two words and I try to tensorize them and I decompose in irreducibles. Well, how does this happen? You have simply to look at all possible decomposition of X as an AZ such that Y starts with Z bar. So what is Z bar? Of course, n star n as a natural involution, namely the one that sends alpha to beta and beta to alpha, and that's anti-multiplicative. Yeah? So you look at all these possible decomposition and you write the UAB. And that's exactly the tensor product rule, the fusion rule in this compact quantum group. Now for us, let me write here what we will use later. Just keep in mind the following strange thing. So in AUF, UX tensor UY is irreducible if, say, last letter of X equals first letter of Y. So that we should keep in mind for later use. If you simply look at the rules here, it's clear that then I have no way, except with Z the empty word, to write such a thing, such an AZ Z bar B, because it exactly says that the last letter of X is the other one than the first letter of Y. And this is, of course, something that from compact groups we don't expect. But of course, in like free groups and so on, it's quite usual. So we should keep this in mind, that quite often, a tensor product of irreducibles in this example can be still irreducible.
That's for every F?
For every F. It's independent of F. So that's also another point that will be used later. So you can look at these quantum groups with several degrees of precision. So the least precise, say, is to just look at the fusion rules. And then you say they are the same for all Fs, as you see here. And one step further is to look at the representation theory as a tensor category, as a C-star tensor category. And then they are still the same for many Fs, but they remember exactly one number, namely the trace of F star F. So that's not an invariant for the tensor category. So this is the representation theory of AO and AU. So let me now show what are some of the operator algebraic properties of these quantum groups. And most of the thing, well, this column will unfortunately be much more rich than this column. But anyway, here we go. So what Banika showed already is that with AU, you get factors, and you get simple C-star algebras, And if F is, say, n by n identity matrix, this is a simple sister algebra with a unique trace. So the Haar state is then the unique tracial state. He also showed that if you take the 2x2 identity matrix, then you get a von Neumann algebra isomorphic to the free group factor on two generators, but this method absolutely does not generalize to higher order matrices. That will be in this column immediately. Now, what I will discuss in the next part of my talk is work that I did with Roland Vernillot, and it shows that both for AO and AU, you get solid von Neumann algebras, you get exact sister algebras, and at least for certain F, but it's certainly true for all Fs, but at least for certain F, meaning that F should be not too far away from identity matrix in some sense, I don't go into that. You get factors without, so full factors meaning not having property gamma, and you get again simple sister algebras. Now, many things are open. So, of course, you could expect that all of these with the identity matrix, IN, the n by n identity matrix, are all free group factors. So, now there are two possibilities. Either they are, either they aren't. And if they are, maybe there is some hope that somebody will prove it. I mean, we agree that if there is some smart way to prove isomorphism with the free group factor, one can be able to do it. But if they aren't, I'm very sure that it won't be proven before many years from now. Yeah. Now, slightly more general, if I don't take the n by n identity matrix, I get, in principle, non-tracial von Neumann algebras, and they could very well all be this isomorphic with one of the Fieracki-Woods factors of Shliaktenko. Again, it's certainly true for the 2x2 matrix with the same methods as Banica used, although nobody really did it. But apart from that, we have absolutely no clue how to prove this. So, slightly in the same direction, even the K-theory of these reduced sister algebras, and remember, the sister algebras were not that difficult to define. I mean, you had this set of relations with U unitary and then U equal F U bar F inverse. Their K-theory is unknown. So, in particular, we expect them to be projectionless, but there is no way to prove that today. And then a final question that might give a clue, maybe to say that they are not free group factors, I don't know. But there are several properties of the free group factors that one could try to check on these von Neumann algebras. Yes, I think it would be interesting if any of these properties are established for these von Neumann algebras arising from these universal quantum groups. Okay, so as you see, most of these things are completely open. So what I will try to discuss now is this exactness and solidity issue of these sister and von Neumann algebras. But let me first explain a few things, and I hesitated a long time to put this slide because there are many people in this room who know much better than I do what all this is about. So, but just to remind you, a unit of sister algebra is called exact if the minimal tensor product with this sister algebra A preserves short exact sequences. Now, for us, it's this result of Takaozawa and Claire and Ramon de la Roche that's important. Namely, if gamma is a discrete group, its reduced sister algebra is exact, even only if gamma admits an amenable action on a compact space. So let me explain this a little bit. So first of all, what is amenability of gamma, just to make the link with amenability of the action? Amenability of gamma, simply one way to say it is that there is a sequence of vectors in little L2 of gamma, all of norm 1, and more invariant under the group elements. Now this can be somehow generalized, so take now X a compact space and gamma an action by homeomorphisms. One way to express the amenability of the action is now to say that instead of just having a sequence of vectors in L2 of gamma, you have a sequence of continuous functions from x to L2 of gamma are normalized, and instead of being more and more invariant, they are more and more equivariant. So lambda g of xi n of x is close to xi n of gx, and this uniformly on your compact space. Now, what is for us the main example? It's also the easiest example where you immediately see everything. So take the free group on k generators and take the compact space of infinite reduced words. So you they are infinite in one direction, say. So you write words for u from the left to the right, infinitely long, and you never have a generator followed by its inverse and so on. Of course, you have an obvious action of the group on the left, and this is such an amenable action, as you can see immediately, because let me say what these functions, how they can be chosen. Well, suppose this is such an infinite reduced word. So every xj is a generator of the, or an inverse of a generator of your free group. And I should map it to a vector in little L2 of gamma. Well, the basic factors in a little L2 of gamma are, I denote them with little delta, so that are one in this group element and zero elsewhere. And then you can take what this is doing is, well, the good way would be to draw the Cayley tree, and then to look at this point at infinity on the Cayley tree, and then xi n is taking like the function that's one on the geodesic, longer and longer and longer, and zero elsewhere, and normalized such that you get the norm one. So then you check as an exercise that it satisfies this amenability property. Okay. Now let me show a really very striking application that Ozawa has given of these exactness and related issues in von Neumann algebra theory. Namely, when he did his work on solid factors. So first of all, what is a solid von Neumann algebra? Let me give the definition for a von Neumann algebra having some trational state, faithful trational state tau. It's called solid if inside this algebra the relative commutant of some diffuse subalgebra must be injective. So diffuse means no minimal projections, and the most striking corollary is to look at this, namely if it's solid and not injective itself, then it must be prime, meaning that if you write it as a tensor product, one of these M1 or M2 must be a matrix algebra. Because if not, if both are diffuse, then of course both should be injective because they are each other's relative commutant, and the M itself would be injective. Now, how did he prove that certain von Neumann algebras have this solidity property? Well, it's by using something very remarkable. Namely, he showed that if gamma is a discrete group, then this group von Neumann algebra L of gamma is solid. If you have much more than exactness, but something in the same direction, namely, you have a compactification of gamma, so such that the action of gamma on itself by left multiplication extends to an action by homeomorphisms of the compactification, such that it is an amenable action, and the action on the other side, on the right, also extends to an action by homeomorphisms, but in such a way that it becomes trivial on the boundary. So, does such a thing exist? Yes, simply think again of our free group. So you had this boundary at infinity of infinite reduced words, and you have this action on one side. Well, a moment of thought shows you that it satisfies both conditions. Now, just another remark. In this case of compact quantum groups, we will often be dealing with non-trational von Neumann algebras, and there is an obvious generalization of this solidity notion to the case where you don't have a trace but a fixed state. It will be our hard state, and where you replace everywhere subalgebra by subalgebra having some state-preserving conditional expectation. So that's just the good generalization. Now, the thing that we will do is to produce for these duals of this compact quantum groups AOF, such kind of boundary actions. But first of all, I should then explain what it means, this kind of dual and this notion of discrete quantum group. So again, a bit of notation. So this was our starting point. We had compact quantum groups and their unitary representations. Now, let us put them all together in a smart way. So if U is a unitary representation, view it as a unitary here. And now put them all together, meaning that you take the set of value reducibles and you choose representatives, UXs, and you define this analog of little infinity of gamma. It's simply an infinity direct sum of matrix algebras. So it's nothing very interesting. The interesting thing comes once you put a co-multiplication on it. And how do you put the co-multiplication on it? In such a way that it entirely encodes the representation theory. So let me explain this in 1 minute. It's a star homomorphism. You take a little a here, and I have to say you what's delta hat of a. Now delta hat of a lives in this, both are sums of matrix algebra, so I should evaluate in x, y, and say which matrix it is. Well, I can't exactly say you which matrix it is, because whenever S is an intertwiner between these two unitary representations, delta hat of A in XY composed with this intertwiner is this. So it's the very natural thing that completely encodes the representation theory, intertwiners, and everything. That's what you should keep in mind. And of course, if you had G, the dual of gamma, you simply find little infinity of gamma, and you simply find multiplication in the group, of course. Okay, now, these boundaries for AOF. So remember that we had the irreducibles labeled by half integers, and that we had these fusion rules here. And I will build you a compactification. Now, what should this be? If you think of gamma, a way, a sister algebraic way to look at the compactification of gamma is simply a sister algebra that sits between C0 and L infinity. That's a sister algebraic way to look at what is a compactification. So that's what we will construct. But it will be in a rather indirect way. So first of all, observe that if I tensorize UN with the fundamental U1, you see that it decomposes in two parts, the one with UN plus 1 and the other with UN minus 1. So this means that UN plus 1 appears with multiplicity 1 in HN tensor H1. So I can choose an isometric intertwiner, and it's uniquely determined up to a scalar. So once I have this isometric intertwiner, I can write a unital completely positive map between these two matrix algebras. I call it psi n. And in fact, the psi n's, they combine into some inductive system of unital completely positive maps, where you send the matrix algebra at Hn to the matrix algebra at Hn. And I would like to consider B as some kind of direct limit. Now, you have an inductive system, so far everything is good, but they are by no means homomorphisms. So the whole question is, you can write some definition of which elements in L infinity of G had I declare to be in B. You see before you what it should be. But then the whole point is, why is this a sister algebra? Why is this closed under multiplication? And this is extremely intricate. And it uses everything one knows about representation theory of SUQ2, where extremely detailed formulas are known about this representation theory, about the angles between intertwiners and everything. So you use a lot of knowledge about SUQ2. And then you say, well, why SUQ2? We are dealing with AOF. Well, what I tried to hint at in the beginning is that from the representation theoretic point of view, AOF and SUQ2, at least for the good Q, are extremely much related. They have the same tensor C-star category of representations. So as far as I'm interested in computing angles between subspaces and so on, all these computations are the same as equivalent computations for SUQ2, and for the computations of SUQ2, you have books with formulas. So, and you have to use them. Now, What's the theorem that we prove with Roland Vergniaud? Namely, that this dual of AOF, then its left and right action on itself extend to an amenable action on B and a trivial action on the other side, and you can deduce solidity and exactness. Now, it's nevertheless important to observe that it's absolutely not so clear what it is, an amenable action of such a discrete quantum group. There is a very delicate issue, but I don't go into that today. And at the end of my talk, I will show you how this kind of ideas here generalize to the case of AU, but that's some recent work in progress. Let's now turn to something different, namely these boundaries that arise in probability theory. But they will, in a minute, become very much related with the boundary that I showed you, because let me explain you one last thing. This B arises as a very strange direct limit using unital completely positive maps, which means that as a sister algebra, you can absolutely don't get your hand on it. The only thing you know is that it's nuclear. This you can, well, you feel that it should be. Yeah? But apart from that, we absolutely don't know which sister algebra it should be. But later, a completely different point of view will give you some generators and relations for this B. And this will then be already a bit more clear. And this will come exactly from this probability theory point of view. So let us first look at the group gamma. So you take a probability measure on gamma, and you look at the random walk with trend that's invariant under the group, so you have a chance of a probability of mu of x inverse y to go from x to y in one step. And you encode this random walk using a Markov operator in this way. And as we will see in a minute, we will be interested in bounded harmonic functions, namely those L infinity functions that are invariant under the Markov operator. So why? Well, let me show you what is the Poisson boundary of such a random walk. So we will all the time assume transience, meaning that almost surely a random walk goes to infinity. And we will also suppose that the support of mu that this probability measure is generating, yeah, because otherwise you, well, anyway. Now, let me explain in three different ways what is the Poisson boundary of such a random walk. So I can give you a characterization, I can show you some interesting properties, and then the definition, which is absolutely abstract nonsense, if you want. I think this is even a precise characterization. At least it gives a good idea what it is. Yeah? But so take this with a grain of salt. But at least it holds for the Poisson boundary. So the Poisson boundary is a probability space with a non-singular action of gamma in such a way that if I write the Poisson integral, namely for an L infinity function on the space, I write this function on the group. This is exactly a bijection between L infinity of y and bounded harmonic functions. So it's a way to represent bounded harmonic functions. That's one way to look at it. Of course, there is another, probably more satisfying way to look at it. Namely, you can realize the Poisson boundary, but it does not characterize it. But you can realize the Poisson boundary by taking a good compactification of gamma, such that almost every path of the random walk converges to a point in this boundary, and such that the probability to end up in U is eta of U. So this gives you a very intuitive idea of what it should be. Now, what is a way to define it? Well, we are von Neumann algebra people, or I am at least, so let me define it as a von Neumann algebra. With probability theory, people probably won't like this, but anyway, let's try it like that. So, look at bounded harmonic functions. Of course, the product of two bounded harmonic functions is not an harmonic function. But, if I take their pointwise product, and I apply the Markov operator many, many times, this converges in the Strong-Scale topology, and this gives me a new product, A dot B. And with this new product, H infinity becomes an abelian von Neumann algebra. Not only it's an abelian von Neumann algebra, but by evaluating functions in the neutral element, I get a faithful state on it. Well, that's L infinity of Y eta. So I agree, this is a completely abstract definition that doesn't tell you anything. So the main problem, of course, in all this thing is I give you a group and a measure. What is this action? Can you identify it with something that we know? So I won't discuss this for groups, but I will discuss it for certain quantum groups. So what does it mean for discrete quantum groups? So remember that this was the way we introduced L infinity of G hat. And now we should realize that this matrix algebra has some favorite state. Remember that we had some favorite matrices on HX that you could use to unitarize U bar. Well, they give some favorite state, as they give the density of some favorite state on P of HX. And now I fix a probability measure on the set of irreducibles. I sum all the psi x's with mu x, and this gives me a new state, psi mu, and it defines a Markov operator. This is simply exactly the same as for discrete groups. Again, I assume transience, some generating property, and I can turn my bounded harmonic functions into a von Neumann algebra. So this is still the completely abstract characterization or definition of what it means to be a Poisson boundary.
Sorry, just to make the product work, you would need a non-commutative Martingale
theorem. Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is what's called a Poisson boundary. And in fact, it arose in this theory of quantum groups in a completely different context. So the definition is due to Izumi, who saw this thing appear when studying actions, minimal actions of compact quantum groups. But I don't go into this. It came from this completely different point of view. So now the problem is, can you identify this kind of boundary action in some concrete examples? So in particular, AO, AU, or others. So let me show a little bit what's known. So the first thing is, maybe you ask, why are you taking this very special state here and not an arbitrary state? Well, they are exactly those states for which this Markov operator sends the center of this algebra to the center. Now, the center of this algebra is just functions on the irreducibles. So once you have this property, you get an ordinary random walk on this set of irreducibles. So you already have some classical thing underlying it. You have this ordinary random walk. And our first, the first identification of Poisson boundaries that were made were in the following very special case, namely where the fusion rules are commutative. Because once the fusion rules are commutative, this classical boundary disappears. It's one point. Okay? And moreover, it can be shown that in that case, everything is independent of the measure. So it's a completely non-classical kind of phenomenon, yeah, because the classical boundary is one point, and that's it. Now we know some of these examples, and the first was done by Izumi, namely, if you take SUQ2, you can in this way identify the Poisson boundary with Podlesch sphere. Namely, SUQ2 has the torus as a closed quantum subgroup, and you have a homogeneous space. And this is exactly then a way to represent, this gives you a way to represent bounded harmonic functions. Mm. Well, Izumi, Nezhvayev, and Tusset have generalized this to SUQN, replacing T by T to the N minus 1. And very amazingly, and that's the topic of the next talk, Reiji Tomatsu was able to completely do this in a very general way. And the result is the following. You take a co-amenable compact quantum group having commutative fusion rules, for instance, SUQN or SUQ2 in particular, and then the Poisson boundary is a completely non-classical object because the classical boundary disappears. It is still a homogeneous space. Oh, here should not be SUQ2. Here should be G. It's a homogeneous space where you divide by K. And what is K? K is the maximal compact subgroup of Kutch type. I should explain what this means. Well, you remember that if I take U bar, I have a representation U, and I look at U bar, it's not necessarily unitary, but it can be unitarized. Well, sometimes it is unitary. And if this is always the case, you call your quantum group of Kutch type. And somehow you have in C of G, a largest subalgebra such that this kind of thing holds, and you feel how you build it, because if I take an arbitrary U, I unitarize U bar, and if I would like that U bar is already unitary itself, I have to declare that certain coefficients are zero. Yeah, it gives me some subalgebra. Well, and that's the way you find this K. Now, what is the tool in all these three things? It's a remarkable thing of Izumi's Poisson integral. So don't bother about what's written here. But the absolutely amazing thing is, the only reason I wrote this is, for those who know what's going on, it shows you that this formula is simply sending everything to a multiple of 1 from the moment on that you get something a billion. L infinity of G is a billion, everything disappears. So it's a completely non-classical thing. It is a completely positive map. It always ends up in the Poisson boundary, and it always ends up with harmonic functions. And the whole point of all these works is to determine the multiplicative domain of these kind of completely positive maps. Well, let me show the last thing now, namely what happens with AO and AU. Well, remember, AO is generated by these relations, and this is the one that gives you SUQ2. And now we will build a very strange sister algebra. Namely, I take the unique Q that satisfies these two relations, and I will take a unital sister algebra with the following relations that a long time I believed were contradictory. Namely, it's a 2 by n matrix, L, is generated by the entries of this L. So L is somehow unitary. So far, so good. This is some Kuntz algebra-like phenomenon. But you also impose that if I take pointwise the adjoints, L is FQ L bar F inverse. And I see no way of, no non-quantum group way to prove that this is a non-zero sister algebra. But it's a sister algebra that arises in much more general context when studying what's called monoidal equivalence between quantum groups. So it's coming from quite far. But it is a non-trivial sister algebra. It has some action of SUQ2 on the one side, on this 2 side, and of AOF on this N side. And there we go. Since you have this SUQ2 action, I can restrict to the torus, which is a subgroup. I take fixed points for that, so I have this quotient, so it's a subalgebra of L, and that's exactly Poisson boundary for the dual of AOF. And the important thing to remark is that this L, this strange thing here, or more precisely, it's fixed point algebra under the torus, that's exactly this boundary sister algebra that we had with this strange direct limit. It's isomorphic. You can prove it. So it gives some hint how it looks like. It is nuclear, but I don't know if it's simple. It probably will be. So here are my two last slides. So just recall what's AU now. AU is with this relation that U and FU bar F inverse are unitary, and these are these fusion rules. And remember what we told here. If X ends with the same letter as the one with which Y begins, UX tensor UY is irreducible. So what's the Poisson boundary? Well, first of all, you have the set of irreducibles. They are, since it's N star N, you can look at it as such a rooted tree. Yeah, you see that you how to label the roots. Well, I take a generating probability measure on the set of irreducibles. This first of all gives me a classical transient random walk on the scaly tree. About random walks on trees, a lot is known, and indeed work of Kaimanovich and others gives you that the Poisson boundary of this classical random walk is given by some measure on the set of infinite verbs. And then I can say, what is the Poisson boundary? Namely, well, how can an infinite word be? Remember that if X ends with an alpha and Y begins with an alpha, I have some tensor, the tensor product is irreducible. And the same if it ends with a beta and starts with a beta. So the only way to, so either an infinite word is some kind of tensor product of finite words, either it's from a certain point alpha, beta, alpha, beta, alpha, beta. Yeah? So these are the two types. Well, eta is not supported in the words with alpha, beta, alpha, beta, so this we throw away. And in the other words, you show that the Poisson boundary, it can be identified with a measurable field of ITPF1 factors, and what is, it's over this classical Poisson boundary, and in such an infinite word, x1 tensor, x2 tensor, x3, the fiber is this infinite tensor product von Neumann algebra. That's where I will stop. Thank you.